So I'm sorry that the other speaker wasn't able to make it, but I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today, and I think listening to Mandy number one's presentation that they will complement each other nicely. So first, in 2006, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, recommended routine immunization with the HPV vaccine for females. The quadrivalent HPV vaccine, HPV4, was approved for use in males aged 9 to 26 years in October 2009. Also in 2009, the ACIP provided guidance that HPV4 can be used for males, but it was not included in the routine immunization schedule for males. At this time, HPV4 was also approved by the Vaccines for Children program for males aged 9 through 18 years. So you just saw some of this data, but the HPV vaccine coverage among females has improved over time but remains lower than ideal, with 44% of females getting one or more doses and 27% of females completing the three vaccine series. Since 2009, we also have new data regarding the efficacy of HPV4 in preventing anal precancer lesions in males, particularly among men who have sex with men who do have a higher risk for HPV-related diseases. So given this information, the ACIP is considering the following options. First, they can continue with their current guidance, which, as you remember, is to say, well, you can use the HPV vaccine in males, but it's not on the routine immunization schedule. They could also recommend routine immunization with a recommendation that would end up being similar to the recommendation that is currently in place for females. And finally, they could decide with one or the other of these other recommendations to decide to target specifically men who have sex with men who are at higher risk for disease. As the ACIP is making these decisions, their considerations include efficacy of the vaccine among males, safety of the vaccine, cost effectiveness, and provider acceptability. So, to provide some guidance regarding provider acceptability, we conducted a survey among a national sample of pediatricians and family medicine physicians. This was to describe physicians' current practices related to the HPV vaccine in females and males, practices related to discussion of sexual health in pre-adolescent and adolescent females and males, knowledge and attitudes about the HPV vaccine for males, and then finally, the intention to recommend the HPV vaccine for males if recommended for routine use by the ACIP and other professional organizations. We surveyed physicians between June and September of 2010. Our surveys were conducted in already existing Sentinel networks that were recruited from random samples of pediatricians from the American Academy of Pediatrics and family medicine physicians from the American Academy of Family Physicians. Only respondents who spent at least half their time in primary care practice were included. And a previous study done by our group compared these Sentinel networks to physicians who were randomly sampled from another group that's often used in surveys, the American Medical Association sample, and found them to be comparable in regards to physician demographics, practice characteristics, and most importantly, attitudes and behaviors related to vaccination. Our survey was developed jointly by our study team and the CDC experts. And we pre-tested this in a community advisory panel, and then pilot tested it among physicians from the AAP and AAFP who were not part of the Sentinel network. We administered our survey by mail or internet based on provider preference, using methods that have previously been shown to increase response rates. So we did have a 72% response rate overall, with 82% of pediatricians responding and 63% of family medicine physicians responding. Respondents were similar to non-respondents in most cases for practice setting, region of the country, and urbanicity. There were a few differences. Overall, respondents were more likely to be female. And for family medicine physicians, respondents were also more likely to practice in an academic, community health center, or public health setting. So first I'll discuss physicians' current practices related to administering and recommending the HPV vaccine for females and males. And the females are really in there to provide a point of reference for the males. So for this slide and all of the ones that follow, we combined the results for pediatricians and family medicine physicians. There were some cases where there were some statistically significant differences between the specialties, but we felt that in almost all of these cases, the differences weren't clinically significant, so they're combined here. You can see that the vast majority of physicians reported that they do currently administer the HPV vaccine to females, so 92%, while only about 30% report that they currently are administering the vaccine to males. This slide shows among the physicians who administer the vaccine, so the N is a little bit different, how frequently they report administering the vaccine in the prior month. So females are above and males are below, and I'll talk about the females first. 52% of physicians said that they usually or almost always administered the vaccine to females. About 28% said that they administered the vaccine about half the time. That's that middle bar. And then 21% said that they occasionally or almost never administered the vaccine to females. So the numbers are a little bit different for males, as is expected. 9% of physicians said that they usually or almost always provided the vaccine to males. 5% said they administered it about half the time, that middle bar. And then 85% said that they almost never or only occasionally administer the vaccine to males. The next slides are about physicians' recommendations for the vaccine. And this is showing their current strength of recommendation in females. 51% of physicians strongly recommend the vaccine for 11 to 12-year-old females, with 36% saying that they recommend the vaccine but not strongly. That's the orange bar. 8% who make no recommendation, and 2% who report that they recommend against the vaccine. I think the notable thing here is that you see that physicians are more likely to strongly recommend the vaccine with increasing age. So 79% strongly recommend among 13 to 15-year-old females, that red bar, and 85% strongly recommend among 16 to 18-year-old females. This is the same data, except now I'm talking about physician strength of recommendation for males. So first of all, overall, fewer physicians strongly recommend for males, as would be expected given the current ACIP recommendation. 14% strongly recommend for 11 to 12-year-old males. 21% say they strongly recommend for 13 to 15-year-old males. And 22% say they strongly recommend for 16 to 18-year-old males. You can see that the majority of the physicians say that they currently make no recommendation for males. But notably, 2 to 4% of physicians say that they recommend against the vaccine in males. Now I'll discuss physicians' practices related to discussion of adolescent sexual health among males and female patients in their practice. So in this case, the females are the green bar and the males are the yellow bar, but none of the differences for female and male patients are significant at all, and they're not clinically significant. So you can see that physicians are more likely to discuss sexual activity with increasing age of the patient. So about 30% discuss sexual activity among 11 to 12-year-olds. About more than 80% discuss among 13 to 15-year-olds, and more than 90% routinely discuss among 16 to 18-year-olds. We also asked physicians whether they routinely discuss sexual orientation at health maintenance visits with both male and female patients of different ages. Once again, there's no differences between female and male patients. You can see that, once again, physicians are more likely to discuss with increasing age. So 11% discuss among 11 to 12-year-olds, about 35% discuss among 13 to 15-year-olds, and about half discuss among 16 to 18-year-olds. Now I'll discuss physicians' knowledge and attitudes about the HPV vaccine, specifically for males. 63% of physicians correctly disagreed that the incidence of HPV-associated anal cancer is similar among men who have sex with men compared to men overall. And notably, 30% said that they didn't know the answer to that question. 73% correctly agreed that the quadrivalent HPV vaccine is efficacious for preventing genital warts in males. 52% correctly agreed that the quadrivalent HPV vaccine has been approved by the VFC program for males, and 41% said they didn't know. 21% correctly disagreed that the CDC's ACIP has recommended the routine use of the quadrivalent HPV vaccine in males, and 30% indicated that they didn't know. Now some attitudes. 53% of physicians strongly agreed, and 36% somewhat agreed, that because HPV is commonly transmitted from males to females, the severity of HPV-associated diseases in females justifies the routine use of the HPV vaccine in males. 31% strongly and 42% somewhat agreed that HPV-associated diseases are severe enough in males to justify routine use of the HPV vaccine in males themselves. 36% strongly agreed and 32% somewhat agreed that it would be easier to administer the HPV vaccine if it were recommended for routine use in both males and females. 35% strongly agreed and 37% somewhat agreed that recommended adolescent vaccines have made male patients more likely to come in for a preventive health visit. 20% strongly and 33% somewhat agreed that it is necessary to discuss issues of sexuality prior to recommending the HPV vaccine to male patients. 14% strongly agreed and 54% somewhat agreed that the parents of male patients will not think it is necessary to vaccinate their sons since they think that HPV infection is primarily of concern among females. And finally, only 4% strongly and 15% somewhat agreed that vaccination efforts should be targeted at females and not males, since HPV infection is primarily of concern in females. We asked physicians, when discussing HPV vaccination with male patients and their parents, how much emphasis would you place on a list of factors? And the factors shown here are the ones that were endorsed most frequently. They were also given the opportunity to answer an open-ended question about that. You can see that the top two, which are really tied, are prevention of genital warts in the patient himself and prevention of cervical cancer in the patient's partners. Next is safety of the vaccine in males, then efficacy of the vaccine in males, and finally, prevention of genital warts in the patient's partners. Now I'll discuss physicians' intention to recommend the HPV vaccine for males if recommended for routine use by the ACIP and other professional organizations, with a recommendation essentially the same as the current recommendation as that for females. So this is very similar to some of the graphs that you've seen before, but this is showing the physician's intention to recommend the HPV if recommended for routine use. Once again, physicians are more likely to strongly recommend at older ages, with 35% saying they would strongly recommend for 11 to 12-year-olds, 59% for 13 to 15-year-olds, 69% for 16 to 18-year-olds. Still, you see some physicians on the far end of the graph, about 3% who would recommend against the vaccine among 11 to 12-year-old males. And I think most notably, 81% said that they would strongly recommend the vaccine for 11 to 18-year-old males who were known to be homosexual or bisexual. And this graph just shows a comparison with physicians' intention to recommend the HPV vaccine for males if recommended for routine use above, and physicians' current recommendations or current reports of recommendations for the HPV vaccine for females below. And I think the notable thing here is just to show that while the two questions weren't the exact same, because one is an intention and one is what they're actually reporting that they're doing now, you can see that it appears that physicians are more likely to still strongly recommend the vaccine for females over males. Our study did have some limitations. Our respondents may have differed slightly from non-respondents who we weren't able to sample regarding attitudes and behaviors related to HPV vaccination. Our sentinel physicians may differ from physicians overall, though our prior work suggests that this is not the case. And finally, our survey results represent reported practices, so what physicians say they are thinking and doing, not what they are actually doing. So in summary, while the vast majority of physicians are currently administering the HPV vaccine to females, only about a third are administering to males. Once again, this is not surprising given that the vaccine is not actually in the routine immunization schedule for males. What is surprising is that only about half of physicians knew that VFC covered the vaccine for males, and about half of the physicians did think that the HPV vaccine was recommended for routine use. We found that physicians are more likely to recommend the HPV vaccine for females and males 13 years and older, and that physicians emphasize prevention of HPV-related diseases in partners when discussing the vaccine with males, and this differs from their approach with females, which we partly know a lot about from the other Mandy. The majority of physicians recognize the increased risk of HPV-related diseases in men who have sex with men. However, about 50% of physicians don't routinely discuss sexual orientation, even with older adolescents. Therefore, a recommendation that was asking pediatricians and family medicine physicians to focus on adolescent males based on sexual orientation would be difficult to implement for that reason and many others. So I welcome questions from you all, but I also have some questions for the group. The first is, should we be linking discussion of HP immunization to discussion of sexual health in males? And the example that you might want to keep in mind in this case is hepatitis B vaccine. So hepatitis B can be transmitted in a number of ways, but one of them is through sexual activity. Yet when we provide the hepatitis B vaccine to infants, we don't have a conversation that this is a sexually transmitted disease. When discussing HPV vaccine for males, should we emphasize protection of the patient himself or protection of his partners and the community in general? So while you're mulling those over, I'd like to thank my collaborators at the University of Colorado in Denver and at the CDC. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Mandy, and I'm actually going to go back a slide so you can ponder these questions some more. And we do have about 15 minutes left for questions, and with so many people in the room, I know somebody has to have a question for one of the Mandys. And if you'll come to the microphone and address them by either Mandy Dempsey or Mandy Allison, that'd be fantastic. Or you can just say, I have a question about HPV vaccine, females or males, and it'll be very obvious who's going to answer.
Well, first I want to say congratulations to the two of you. Fascinating research. My name is Carlos Velasquez. And I'm interested to know, at this point, the majority of the HPV vaccination outlets, are they within physician's office, or are they within community clinics? Are they within, you know, visiting nurses that apply them? That's the first question. And second thing, just a comment, that there's a context to everything. I'm not surprised that, you know, the majority of the doctors will not talk about sexual orientation. Homophobia is an attitudinal barrier that needs to be addressed in relation to this vaccination uptake, and it can't be, you know, ignored. I remember back in 2000, people might giggle, I went to my doctor after going to a conference and asked questions about an anal pap smear, and I said, I want to know about it, and I want to actually have it done. Doctor told me to come back in 2 weeks. He had no clue what I was talking about. Without that information, and without that advocacy that patients can need to do for themselves, the answer to that question is both. That, and not only is it important to talk to, especially young people, millennials seem to be more motivated by what they do for others as opposed to themselves, but there's a context to everything.
That was a lot of comments. Thank you for those. As far as the question about where are HPV vaccines being delivered, I believe that most of them are being delivered in the primary care offices, but it's a combination. I mean, there's obviously school-based clinics. There's some outreach activities, but when this has been looked at, I think most of them are still being delivered in the medical home and then a fair proportion in the health departments, but mostly in the medical home.
And I do think that I think that tomorrow there's an update. I'm plugging another presenter, but I think that tomorrow there's an update on adolescent vaccines where they might have some more specific details.
Can you come to the microphone that won't be recorded unless you do? Thank you. Good morning. My name is Kim. I'm from Georgia. I just had a question about sometimes the patients will start HPV and they may not get finished up, maybe a couple of years or so. How effective is it, you know, if we go ahead and finish it up, but how effective is it? Do y'all have any kind of data on that?
So I know that some of the drug manufacturers are looking at some of that. I think it's tough because when they do their drug trials, they sort of study it at the recommended interval. And the vaccine hasn't been around long enough to sort of fully answer that question yet. So I don't think that there's anything published there yet. But, you know, I think most folks would say, if you start it, it's better to finish it than to just give up.
The CDC recommendation actually is that there is no maximum interval between first and last dose, and at any time, if a patient has started the series, that it should be finished whenever they come in under the recommended ages.
Joe Szymanski from Pennsylvania. In your research, I know it was based on mothers. Did you come across any data or look at any data referring to the fathers? Because, I mean, I'm one of them ones. That's why I'm here.
We actually, in our qualitative study that we did where we looked at reasons why parents did or did not vaccinate, it was initially going to be a mothers and fathers study. And when we recruited for that study, we asked for the person who makes the primary decisions about vaccination. And we got a couple fathers, but there's only like two out of about 60 people. And so it's not to say that fathers are not important. And certainly in some cultures, like mothers won't make a decision without the father's input. So, I mean, that's a recognizable, important aspect. But I'd say if you're looking at sort of the first pass of where you can get the most bang for the buck, it's mothers. Those have been shown in other studies that mothers are the primary decision makers about vaccination and other health decisions at a population overall level. So fathers are definitely a target for some future work.
Hi, I'm Richard Judelson from New York State. First of all, two wonderful presentations. Along that line, did anything come up, maybe that wasn't being queried in a standardized way, about how the girls felt in the study in Michigan? Also, was there any preliminary information that you as investigators got in either community where a light bulb went on that here's an area that we've now identified is a real either a barrier or a real advantage to how to sell HPV vaccines?
So in answer to your first question, we didn't ask anything about what the daughters felt about the vaccine in the study that I presented today. We've asked that in other studies, and other groups have asked that too. So it's pretty clear that a lot of mothers want their daughters' input into the vaccination decision. So it's more of a joint decision rather than an individual decision. And so some of the work that we're doing now with the CDC study actually is we're interviewing adolescents and their parents to kind of get a sense of how often these ideas agree or disagree and how we can kind of mesh all of those together. As far as the second question of, like, were there any things that came up as a good way to sell or not sell, the short answer is not really, because I think everybody has it's such a complicated decision and everybody has such differing things that really resonate with them as to why they do or don't want it. It really depends a lot on your own past experiences, I think, with vaccination and with diseases and with your kids and everything. So that's why we try to take an individual-based approach. But I will say that we're actually working on one study right now that is going to investigate different ways of framing the same material about HPV. So this is a study for college-age girls, and so we're going to be testing, like, showing pictures of genital warts versus just describing them in text. So I think that will potentially be a a very interesting result from that. And then we're also testing, looking at sort of describing the risks, potential risks and benefits to vaccination versus just the benefits. So,
yeah, on that subject, I work a lot in communicating about vaccine safety, and that's now the gold standard for communication. Right. Show them the pictures of
right.
what happens when you don't vaccinate.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Mahoney from the state of Maine, and I guess my question is for both of you, if you have any input in the group as well. We have lots of providers that won't vaccinate with HPV for boys because it's a permissive recommendation, so they don't have to do it. So, you know, sort of that barrier of getting over that, and what can you say to these providers? Because technically they don't have to do it.
And I think, you know, there aren't a lot of cases of permissive recommendations, mm-hmm. and I think you saw from our data that, so they're confusing. The permissive recommendations are really confusing to providers and to those of us who are, I'm a provider, but also working with providers about immunizing, because I think, I don't know that I have an answer to your question, but I'll just say it's a tough question because of that permissive recommendation. But I do think that that's part of what's driving the working group on the ACIP to feeling like they may need to make a stronger stance in one way or the other so that it can be more clear to physicians. Because I think that lack of clarity in itself is a big part of the problem. And then since I've been sitting here, you know, I showed you our results and we got a range of answers, particularly among physicians responding about the vaccine for males. And definitely had physicians who emailed us and responded very passionately on sort of both ends of the spectrum to being, you know, very against the vaccine for males and being very proactive for the vaccines for males. And listening to the other Mandy's talk, I was thinking, you know, the idea of doing tailored interventions for physicians mm-hmm. is probably also the way to go.
Right. Well, let's just hope it becomes a regular ACIP recommendation. It'll make things easier.
Hi, my name is Megan Jacobs. I'm with the National Vaccine Program Office. And I was curious if any research is being done to look into whether or not there's a change in attitudes among more newly licensed physicians or people who are coming through the medical school system right now who are more likely to have actually been vaccinated themselves. They kind of came at the beginning of the HPV vaccination when it was really first licensed, and it's likely that more of them have actually been vaccinated. And I was curious if in your research you found anything about new physician attitudes, younger physician attitudes versus older.
We did do a multivariable analysis that I didn't present here because it ended up not saying a lot different anything than I already showed you. But we did look at the year of medical school graduation. Mm-hmm. So that's not exactly the physician's age, right? Because some of us take different paths. But it's a decent proxy. And we did not find a difference based on physician age. But we're almost, really our population is still a little bit too old. I think it's a really good question. But we're not, most of them aren't quite out there yet, or we don't have enough of them out there yet to answer it, I think.
Sure. They're kind of going through residency now, so it might be worth exploring in a few years to see how that cohort has a changed attitude about the vaccination for males and for females.
It's a great question.
Thanks.
Hi, Sandy DiAgostino from New York State. And mine is just a comment and goes along with the permissive recommendation that the lady before was speaking about. And that's with a permissive recommendation, the insurance companies aren't reimbursing, which I think is a huge factor in why a lot of our physicians aren't embracing vaccinating males. And even though it's accepted or the VFC is covering it, there's a disparity in your practice between vaccinating a group who is covered against a group who's not. So I think that's a huge consideration, too.
And I think just we asked about, I also didn't present data about mm-hmm. barriers, but we asked about that. And, I mean, you're right on. It are very consistent with what our data mm-hmm. showed that, you know, the two biggest barriers, not surprisingly, were, and someone else got at this earlier, adolescents don't come in mm-hmm. to get the vaccine. And then the next biggest barriers were vaccine financing issues. So it's an enormous issue.
But two great presentations. Thanks.
We still have a few more minutes. Come on up.
Hi, good morning. At our lunch roundtable, we kind of had a discussion around HPV, looking at completing the series. And while I'm not a clinical person, I am an educator. And I found it kind of strange that providers kind of pulled HPV out to be the one adolescent vaccine to really discuss in detail. And I'm wondering, why is that the case when we don't make a big deal about Tdap or about meningococcal, but we pull this one out? And I think for a lot of parents, when you say HPV, immediately they're thinking, well, what are you saying about my daughter? Or what are you saying about my son? So instead of having a specific discussion, wouldn't it be more beneficial to say, here is a group of vaccinations that your child needs as an adolescent. Here are the VISs for these vaccines. If you have questions, let's talk about it, rather than make this an issue that's just about sex. Because if you ask your 11, 12-year-old, all they know is they got four shots that hurt. So I just wanted to see what you guys thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. And unfortunately, I think the problem has been that there's been so much media controversy about the vaccine that most parents now have this sort of automatic link between HPV vaccine and sex, or HPV vaccine and controversy. And so even, I know personally, even when I do approach parents that way, they're often the ones that single out the HPV vaccine. They're like, yeah, I'll get the other ones, but what about this one? So I think there's a larger issue at work here, which is that the media continues to sort of feed into this whole idea that HPV vaccines are controversial, and it just keeps the cycle going.
Good morning. Ralph Wimmer from Colorado. Wow, that's loud. I want to just compliment both of you for the presentations, but Mandy from Michigan, I want to say I'm very excited about the broad application of this idea in public health.
Yes.
It has so many places that I could see the benefit. I work in the STI and HIV world, and I can just see lots of application. And to Mandy Allison, my colleague from Colorado, in answer to this question that you posed, or this discussion point, the first one, no one is comfortable, it appears to me, in this discussion of sexual health, regardless of the point in life a person is at. And we just have many experiences, including my personal one, of my clinician not raising the issue at all at my annual physical. I find that of great concern, and I've been in this business for about 25 years, and I don't see movement. So I differ with the lady who just spoke. I think we need to address this very specifically as a sexual health issue. We're sexual beings. We can't avoid the discussion. We have to address it head on. Thank you.
And I think, you know, as times change in our society, sort of our ideas about sexuality are changing. And that it's a fascinating topic to me. And one that's hard for me to apply in practice as well, though. I have certain attitudes about it in theory, but it's much harder to apply in practice. And it's partly that providers don't have the tools or training. Mm-hmm. So for any health educator types out there, you know, I think it's a fascinating area to go into, about how do providers address these issues in a comfortable way, starting at a young age with children, so that by the time they're, you know, making more of these decisions, it's not like you're suddenly popping out the sex, drugs, and rock and roll questions, but, you know, that it's become part of your standard practice, and they're more comfortable discussing those things. But there's a lot there. I don't have any answers, but there's a lot there.
And it's a more broad issue than just in the health arena, mm-hmm. in that I just had a discussion with our HR people about how to ask about sexual orientation. It's just a big problem that we're very uncomfortable with collectively, mm-hmm. and we've got to get over it. Thank you.
Just to follow up on my question, because there's a context to everything. And while I applaud the research in relation to tailoring messages and targeting messages, it's important to consider the context of a different kind of stigma, and that is documentation status. That access to health for a lot of people in this country, the primary care is emergency room. Mm-hmm. Okay? And even the Affordable Care Act negates care for 18 million people living in this country. We can't forget that Latinos need to have messages that are tailored, that are specific, that are culturally relevant, and we know that even homophobia exists very well within Latinos.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, this is a this is a first pass at tailoring, trying to reach the most people with the least amount of money. But I definitely think that future work will need to sort of focus in a little bit more on specific subpopulations because they do have different barriers. It's pretty clear. So.
Hi, good morning. I'm Ingrid Lewis, Washington, D.C. I just wanted to say that thinking from a parent's perspective, a parent of boys and girls, I do believe the vaccine is safe. I do definitely believe that. But thinking as a parent, my biggest question was, will it affect their reproductive system long term? And that's a question that can't be answered at this time because the vaccine is still very new. But for parents, I want us all to understand our kids are having sex. They are having sex at a very young age, and they are practicing behaviors that we couldn't even imagine. So, with that in mind, we really should be realistic to say, okay, there is a vaccine. It is deemed to be safe. Do your research as a parent. You know, be your own advocate for your children and gather the information and then decide as a family, is this a vaccine that my children need at this time?
I get asked that question fairly frequently about the reproductive effects of the vaccine. And the way that I tend to answer that is I say, well, you're right, we don't know for sure, although biologically speaking, there's no reason to think that the vaccine would have any impact on reproductive health. I mean, there's nothing about that vaccine that targets the reproductive area more than any other vaccine that we give. But what we do know is that there is a very significant impact of on reproductive health from HPV infections. So for women who are treated with LEAPS or conization for cervical dysplasia, they have a very much increased risk of having preterm delivery or not being able to carry a fetus to term. So again, I think it's important to acknowledge people's concerns, but then when possible, sort of provide the other side of the issue, which I don't think a lot of people are aware that cervical dysplasia does have an impact on your reproductive health in a way that's quantifiable, whereas there's a theoretic concern that's not really biologically based, at least as far as we know right now, about the vaccine. So,
I'd like to give our presenters in the round of applause. If you have a question...